Look alive, sunshine.
109 in the sky, but the pigs won't quit. You're here with me, Dr. Death Defying. I'll be your surgeon, your proctor, your helicopter, bumping out the slaughtermatic sounds to keep you alive. A system failure for the masses. Antimatter for the master plan.
This is Comics Therapy, Episode 4. No reviews, just analysis. Today, we'll be talking in depth about three books from August 14th, 2013. Mind the Gap number 12, Infinity number 1, and The True Lives of the Fabulous Killjoys number 3. So if you haven't read them yet, consider yourself warned. We're going to spoil them. We're also diving into the first six issues of The Walking Dead, originally published in 2008, for our new segment, Grief Counseling. But more on that in a bit.
Hi, my name is Cameron Wasgo on Twitter, and my confession is I've read so few DC comics that most knowledge I have of their characters comes from Wikipedia.
Hey kids, welcome to Comics Therapy. As we'll remind you each week, neither Aaron nor I is a licensed psychotherapist. We'll be discussing perception, self-identity, fear, and the importance of myth and legend in times of need. You know, the universal stories of humanity. Yep, all of this is from this week's comics, but we urge you not to take any of the following banter as serious medical advice, or even good life choices.
Hey, don't forget nerd confessions in between segments. Are you itching to get a deep, dark, geeky secret off your chest? Like you harbor an undying love for the West Coast Avengers?
Of course.
Leave us a message. We'll feature it in an upcoming episode of the show. All the details are on our website, comicstherapy.com. It's just right there on the right-hand side, all the ways to contact us. Remember, catharsis is cool.
If you're looking for us in between episodes, Aaron can always be found on Twitter at Aaron Myers.
And Andrea is usually reachable at Andrea Shock.
The show has a mind of its own, so it has its own account too, at Comics Therapy. Let's get down to business. Aaron, how was your week?
Oh, there was a lot of comics to read this week. I think I'm going to start every show that way.
How about other non-comics related things?
Life's fine. I sold all my magic cards.
Yeah. Yeah.
So coming off the heels of last week.
Making fun of you for that last week, you just shucked them all out the door. Nice.
Yeah. Well, I sold a lot of the really expensive ones already. So I had about 80,000 left over, but it's all the ones that are kind of worthless. But there's always somebody willing to take it.
So 80,000 cards. And what did that what did that earn you?
About $800.
$800 spent immediately on comics, I'm assuming.
No, I'm saving some of it for the Rose City Comic Con.
Oh, excellent. When is that?
That's end of September. So, looking forward to that. That's why I started this week, too. You know, it's only a month away, so or a little over a month away. So, I started going through, starting to pull out comics to get signed. You know, I like to do that ahead of time. I'm a planner.
You're obsessive.
No, I'm organized. Everyone always comments when I'm at the con. They see my little box with all the tags and the creators and the things to get signed. I get it all prepped ahead of time, so I'm not like spazzing out in front of a table.
That's good. No, I'm sure that creators appreciate that. I'm sure that at the end your experience is more streamlined and less hectic than a lot of the rest of us. Are you taking Luke with you?
No way. A con would not be fun for a three-year-old, especially like I'm only going to be there for one day, so like, you know, I can't justify like going 2 days in a row to a con and leaving the family. So
sure.
It's pretty compressed for me. Like I have kind of I guess it's obsessive, but I just try to maximize it. Like,
right.
I have a list of here are the people I want to see. Here's their booth, you know, booth. So I can kind of make it efficient because I don't have that much time there. And there's usually at all these cons, there's a lot of people I want to talk to.
Do you do panels or just people?
I never really do panels because it takes up too much time. Hmm. And there's always like when I went to Stumptown, a while back, like there were tons of good panels, but there were so many people I wanted to see there. It's like that took up the entire day.
Yeah.
You know, I definitely have an anxiety fear of like trying to shuffle through back issues to get signed for someone and like just wasting their time and everything. But that's kind of like that permeates throughout life. Like I definitely like to be organized because I have these social anxieties.
How old do you think you want Luke to be before you start taking him with you?
We'll see at 4, probably like 5 or older. Plus, the cons here are pretty, they're not like a ton of cosplayers or like things I think would be fun for a kid. Like, you know, like San Diego or something would be fun for a kid because there's a ton of...
Oh my God, I totally disagree. San Diego is so overwhelming. How is that fun for anybody?
Well, if you're not like crushed in with the crowds, like there's so much stuff going on that you could make it fun for a kid. You know, instead of dragging them like through Artist Alley or something like that.
I dragged Avi through Artist Alley at the Big Wow in San Jose. And he was almost 8 at the time. So it's a completely different perspective than a 3-year-old or even a 4 or 5-year-old. But I think he was old enough to get into it and sort of appreciate what he was seeing and the potential, the range of what he was seeing.
Mm-hmm. And do you think he... Did he get into your excitement too? Like, I don't know at what age kid either lose that or gain it back, you know, like to see their parents excited about something.
Yes and no. Part of it, and we talked about this, it does so completely change the adult experience when you have a kid in everything, right? But if you have a kid with you at a con, then the order of operations is different. The entire schedule of the day is different. So my excitement and his excitement had to be in balance. There were things that we did that day, like stand in line for a stupid hot dog for him. It was not exciting for me. It was, in fact, the opposite of exciting for me, but was a necessary result of having a kid with me.
Yeah.
And so what I would have done and the schedule that I would have maintained myself kind of went out the window. And that was intentional. I chose to take him because it was a relatively small experience for him to not be overwhelmed by.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if you were going to consider taking Luke in the next year or two, the smaller cons are so much more accessible. Partially because there is not as much going on.
Yeah.
And so it's not as overwhelming. They had a little Nerf archery booth thing. They had a really small kids area with coloring sheets. We bypassed that. We did the archery thing because that was hilarious. But we mostly just focused on walking around and looking at stuff. And that was cool. He got into that. And so our excitement... together was we were able to play off of one another in a different way than I've ever had before. So that was awesome. I was super excited to have that first chance to take him.
I think I'd have to readjust and come to terms with some of like the anxieties I have, especially at a con, where I feel almost like when I walk up to somebody's table, that's why I try to plan it, that if I walk up to somebody's table and I'm looking at their work that they're, you know, that somebody's done and put time and effort and passion into, I almost feel obligated to buy something from them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's hard to hard to like window shop for me at a con, like to like look at it and be like, oh, flip through their, you know, their mini comics or their graphic novel or something like that they put together and then just go like, thank you. Hey, good luck to you. You know, walk away. Like
right.
To me, it's like, I just can't do that. That's why I try to have things like super planned out, because I don't mind looking at people's tables, but I almost do it weirdly like from afar.
I agree. I think that's sort of what Avi and I did, partially because, let's be honest, there's some content that I wasn't excited about exposing him to.
Yeah.
And so walking up and down the floor and looking at things from afar was a way to vet the content before we got closer, before we actually picked up the mini comics or flipped through somebody's portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
It was not always like a guaranteed way. In other words, some stuff got through my initial vetting system, but it was a reasonable way to both prevent me from feeling that obligatory need to buy every single thing that we stopped to take a look at, but yeah. also it gave me time to balance the difference between being at a con by myself and with Avi. Mm-hmm. It was like a learning curve for both of us at the very beginning. It is a very, very different experience. And I think, like a lot of things, you and I approach the entire world of this in a slightly different way. Not slightly, a very, very different way. And the organization that you go through to get ready, and ultimately your end goal is very different from mine. And so it might actually be more difficult to incorporate Luke into that.
Yeah.
Whereas I was just more flexible and like, hey, let's just go fuck around. This is going to be fun. Whatever.
Right. Yeah. And to me, it's like, this is like my one, you know, to three chances a year to meet people that I'm really into their work, you know?
Right.
And there's also, there's so many levels of anxiety for me at a con. Like, ultimately, they've always been fun, but the experience of meeting people too has a lot of kind of anxiety couched in it for me too. It's like every meeting is a first date with a creator. Like, you don't want them to be a jerk and you don't want to do something that's dumb too in front of them. Right. It's like when you add a toddler to it, that's a lot of unknowns. I mean, maybe at the same time, it's also a nice icebreaker because you've always have a kid sure. like, be like, oh, hey, sorry, okay, hey, good to meet you. And
also, if it's somebody who in any way you've exposed your child to, mm-hmm. it can be more than an icebreaker. It can be almost a gift to that person. And obviously not every creator feels the same way about kids or about content and kids, but I think that there are individuals who I've spoken with who have a appreciation for mm-hmm. kids and comics and the need to, I promise we were not going to get into my soapbox. I promise. It's like nowhere on the agenda for the show, but just the need to encourage young comics readers that it can be really lovely to have a creator who I respect and whose work has been really important to me, interacting with my son and recognizing the importance of a new lover of comics to help sustain the industry as a whole. That is an interaction that I have gotten a lot of joy out of.
Yeah, I can see the value in that. Things change so quickly with kids. Like right now, I can't imagine doing that. But in a year, I don't know. You know, it just hit the way he is evolving as a person. It grows so quickly. And I think maybe how I'm kind of evolving as a parent too, like breaking out of my kind of comfort zones too. Mm-hmm. So we'll see. We'll reevaluate in a year. We'll see where we're at.
Yeah.
Well, anything else from this week? How was your week?
I'm still on vacation, so I'm fine.
So same thing. Getting drunk
back
on the
from
beach.
The beach. Nah. Back from the beach. We are in Pittsburgh for 2 days. Fly back to San Francisco on Monday. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, good stuff.
Yeah, exciting.
Staying with my parents and hanging out. And I still have fabulous beach hair. So, I mean, ultimately, that's the most important thing.
Yeah, mission accomplished.
We'll see how long it lasts. It's a shockingly more humid here than it was in Bethany. So my prediction is not long, and oh well.
Well, keep us posted.
It's really why everybody is tuning in. How Absolutely. Fabulous is Andrea's hair? Right now, it's super fabulous. Yep.
Great. Well, you know, our hourly reports.
Yes.
Well, do you want to talk about some comics?
Let's talk about some comics.
Our first book this week is Mind the Gap number 12, published by Image Comics. Mind the Gap is written by Jim McCann and drawn by Rodin Esquillo. That's the worst pronunciation I've ever done.
Yeah. Yes, it's definitely incorrect, but I cannot correct you either.
Okay, good. Well, then
maybe
we can
somebody move. Will. So, Mind the Gap is a story about Elle, who is in a coma. She's a 20-something, early 20-something young woman. Her best friend and her boyfriend, and then eventually a number of other allies, are trying to figure out exactly what happened to her and to help save her. That makes it sound like a much more mundane operation than it actually is. But in each issue, we get a sense of who is on which side. Unfortunately, allies, or traditional allies, are like parents, for example, are not on Elle's side. We think. Her mother and her doctor are up to like super crazy shit and maybe are behind the attack or at least complicit in it. Her dad is in on it. One of the taglines for this book is that everyone is a suspect, and it is unfolding in a really sort of fascinating, like murder mystery kind of way. However, the thing that makes this book different and like really the hook is that Elle can jump into the bodies of other comatose patients. So her consciousness, and we see her in this kind of waiting area that is kind of a lovely construct that Jim McCann has come up with, can leave that waiting platform and go into various bodies, during which time she can communicate with her best friend or with her brother or whomever. Mm-hmm. So we've got all of these layers of mystery, and we've got this supernatural component, but not in a scary way. Woohoo! We'll get to that later. And that's Mind the Gap. And there's a lot of stuff going on here in terms of consciousness and what is real and what isn't real. And it is a lovely balance between these self-discovery mysteries and then the kind of larger mystery about exactly who is responsible for the state that she's in.
Mm-hmm. Did this read more as a mystery book to you, or to me I don't want to make it sound like negative, but it's so much soap opera too.
Yeah, no, I know you've used that word a couple of times, and I think I was resistant because of the negative connotation, but I don't disagree. I think mm-hmm. that the circular nature of the way that we're discovering things about her family mm-hmm. is very operatic. I think because it's not an epic scale of story. I mean, I guess it could be because we've got this plane of unconsciousness that is seemingly right. endless. Mm-hmm. But at least in the real world, the scale is still pretty small. The players are interconnected, but they are manageable in size right now.
Right.
I think that soap opera, to me, has this just kind of wider scope that I don't think is necessarily applicable here. But the family drama is fascinating just because it goes against traditional roles of protector, parents protecting their children, or in this case, the opposite. We think, I don't know, this last issue, there was a lot more conversation about saving her and making sure that she is able to be resuscitated. And I'm sure there's a lot more to behind the motivation of her mother, especially.
Yeah, we have to see. I mean, it's a very slow burn book. And I think that's why it was kind of interesting. I was interested in talking to you about it because I've been reading it in issues. And reading in issues is very kind of jarring sometimes because you have to really reset and go back and try to remember what happened, because there's so much. The whole book is about interpersonal, connections, and mm-hmm. there is a pretty decent amount of characters. So I think reading this, my assumption is reading this in trade makes it feel a lot more linear, and it's a lot easier to follow.
I don't disagree. And my experience reading it all in one sizable chunk speaks to that. But I think we use that so often. Really, we're talking about a medium here that is serial by nature. When is it not going to flow better in trade?
I don't know. I mean, that's a different debate for comic in general.
Like, right.
And I think let's save that for when we talk about our next book, because I think that's something that's worth debating about that. In this, I feel two things. I don't know. I don't think it's written to be a TV show, but it feels like it could be easily a TV show in that way. Each episode, each issue is very, you know, here's your arcs and your resolution or cliffhanger, which is also like why I kind of feel about the soap opera aspect of it, that it's like every issue ends, and this is a comics a lot of the time, but this is very, it ends on a very dramatic cliffhanger, which is very, is part of the style of the book and, and why I like it too. That these are all kind of execution discussions on the book, but there's a lot more going on. It's not just the interpersonal, like all the interpersonal drama going on is almost like kind of distraction from, I think, the main part of the story. And it's really hard to decide right now what's going on with that. This whole, her whole powers, quote unquote,
right.
of being able to jump into other people's body. I mean, it has so much going on with it. It's there's a sci-fi aspect of it, but it's such a psychological aspect of, like, you know, when we're talking about this week, you were talking about you need to brush up on your Freud. You really need to brush up on your Jung, you know, like to me, it's like the whole, this is the whole kind of exploration of the collective unconscious and like where the body and the soul and the mind end or are connected.
Right.
And then I guess we're all connected in some way. And I think that's really what the book's exploring.
Well, and then the mind and body itself. I did some cursory rereading of just various philosophies about individual consciousness and the mind-body problem, Descartes, so on and so forth. Looking at the way throughout history we have considered the relationship between our individual consciousness, our individual body, and then kind of the larger group consciousness, the way that those could or could not interact on various planes. It's fascinating stuff. And I think you're right. We don't have enough information to know exactly what is happening with, and I hesitate to use the word soul, although that word has been used in the book, but with Elle and where she is and kind of what is real and how much her mind has constructed and how much it hasn't. And so that's the supernatural question that I'm simplifying by just tossing it aside and saying that's the science fiction, that's the supernatural, that's the hook that is making this family drama and this other mystery stuff kind of more compelling.
That's what keeps me coming back to the book. It's the larger picture of not only the conspiracy for why she's in this state, but why she, you know, what's special about her and what's being done. And this feels to me, it's like, this is like a 100-issue kind of story.
Well, I think it's really interesting, your point about the pacing, because Jim McCann has a lot of experience writing in television. The delivery of the story speaks to that. I think that that's something that sort of works with the distance that you're describing. Like, the 100 issues is like an easy number to throw out, but like when you look at the development of a story over that length of time versus a mini series, the pacing is going to understandably ebb and flow. And again, we're going to talk about that with Infinity. But I think that is one of the reasons why this story in this medium is working for me, is that big picture, small picture is really balanced. The the introduction of character and the interaction of character has been consistently inconsistent. If you'll bear with me, I'll explain. We're learning who they are and who their allies are in a way that is pretty consistently giving us enough to move forward, but not enough to kind of ruin the mystery. Her brother, for example, did not stay an enemy for too long so that we couldn't then sympathize with him when we learned enough about him to make him more interesting. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. So, you can tease something for so long, but you have to reveal. Otherwise, people will never feel satisfied.
And also, if you wait too long before you give us this nugget of information about a character that may make him more sympathetic, may make his motivations, like on the micro level, more explainable, if you wait too long, then you've missed that opportunity. And he's no longer as interesting because we've seen him behave in this one-dimensional way for too long.
Yeah.
And so even in the case of Elle's parents, where there's obviously some like fucked up stuff going on there with why they would be okay with putting her in the position she's in to begin with, it is not cut and dry. And I have enough information to not write off her parents as like evil bad guys. And that's really important in a longer series. So that it's not just black and white. So that we want to know exactly what's happening and how much does Elle understand? How much did she kind of agree about the procedure that she underwent, or is she about to experience? Maybe all along she's been into this and has been lying to who we connect with now, her best friend and her boyfriend, and that is also intriguing to me. So I think that McCann is doing a very admirable job of keeping us involved with the pacing. But again, I read it in one big chunk. I'm not reading it issue to issue, and I think that my appreciation for that pacing might shift slightly as I start to read it now. Issue to issue.
Yeah, I think this will be a good one to revisit, you know, six more issues, like the next, by the end of like the next trade, like, you know, issue 18 or something like that, and see how we feel stylistically about it too. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot. It's almost like, it's weird to say like at 12 issues, it's like, it's hard to talk about what's going on because we don't know a ton of what's going on, but there's a lot of pieces set up on the board.
I think the other thing I want to point out, and this is so much about me as a reader, that if there is something that I connect with very personally or very intellectually, then I'm like a reader for life, right? If there's something that at the beginning grabs its hooks into me, and in this case, Elle and her world is very much the world of theater. She's a stage manager, her best friend is a costume designer, her boyfriend is a technician, and that's my world, and it doesn't take much for that to suck me in. It is so rare when those two worlds overlap, when comics and theater kind of match in a way, in a storytelling way. It just doesn't happen very often. It happened in Lock and Key, and that was one of the things that I really kind of loved, the layering that happened in that story as well. But in Mind the Gap, it is an overwhelming part of the story and about who they are, and I love that. I mean, I've been listening to Title of Show all week, because of this book, which incidentally is like a fantastic musical. If anybody wants to check it out, you absolutely should, because there are a lot of references to that part of their world. And it's nifty to see something that I know in a different way, communicated in a different medium, but then having this layer of like mystery and mayhem and supernatural and blah on top of that. Like it's a really unique combination of real and not real for me. And I dig that big time.
Mm-hmm. Good. I'm glad you liked it. Yeah. It'll be fun to revisit it here.
Absolutely.
Hey, Comics Therapy, this is Amir Kat again. I need to confess another thing. Spider-Man is actually not in my top 16 best comic book characters. He might not even be in my top 20. I just feel like he might be an amalgam of like what a nerd or what a person Lee thought would read comic books at the time. A nerd who gets girls, who is athletic or whatever, but and I like all those aspects, but for some reason, I just don't like the character. I also wanted to confess that from time to time, I do wear a trench coat, dark glasses, go into a comic book store and buy a variant cover. I do buy a variant cover from time to time if they're by my favorite artist. Okay, bye.
Well, shall we move on?
We should, because we've got this thing hanging over us, and I'm going to call it Infinity One, like everyone else is calling it.
Mm-hmm.
It's written by Jonathan Hickman, penciled by Jim Cheng, and inked mostly by Mark Morales. But there are a ton of credits in this book, so you should check it out to see the full range of creators. There's also a special Infinite Digital comic released. I believe that that will continue to be the case with the rest of this event, which is published by Marvel Comics. Aaron, for me, for the fans, tell us briefly what is happening in Infinity One.
Well, you can't do that. You can't do it briefly.
You can't do it.
Why would you want to read a book that you can briefly explain?
Well, you're
especially,
right.
Especially an event.
Well, and especially one steeped in such stuff as this one.
Yeah, I mean, it is a... So, here... I've got so much to say about this. It's really hard to organize my thought. But, I loved this. And I saw such mixed reviews about this. And it's also the same kind of people who either love or hate his Avengers books right now, too.
Hickman's.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think it speaks very much to the type of reader someone is if they like or dislike his current Avengers and now Infinity runs. And it's an interesting kind of comics debate in that way of does a comic need to have resolution at the end of every... every little arc or every issue. I mean, the way it used to be back in the day, and I think a lot of people still expect that, is here's your conflict, here's your battle, and here's your resolution. End of 23 pages.
Mm-hmm.
And Hickman doesn't write books that way. And those are, and I appreciate that a lot more. It's also a matter of trusting the writer too. And I guess maybe some people just don't trust that the execution and the resolution of a larger story will pay off for them. And I don't blame them. I mean, a lot of, event books just end up being duds. You know, most people get burnt out on them because they start out really interesting or it's a really cool concept and they just don't pay off.
Right.
You know, so maybe there's part of that, but this is far more different than any of the other stuff that's been in the past, in my opinion. I mean, it's much bigger too. And I mean, let me ask you. I mean, do you hate that you kind of have to do homework?
No.
For Hickman?
No, I definitely have never hated the homework part of Hickman.
Mm-hmm.
So much of the appeal of the Avengers for me has been the character. It's the only appeal. The action and the conflict and the resolution is the forum for the characters to be on display. But if I don't have a chance to interact with the characters that I grew up with and that I really love, then I get frustrated. I don't give up, but I miss the stories where the characters and the interplay between the characters is more natural. And maybe when the stakes are not as high. But that doesn't mean that build up to events of this type or stakes that are this high are not interesting. Obviously, I'll be able to respond a little bit more appropriately in the aftermath, but no, I don't resent homework, but I also don't have to do like as much homework as somebody who is less familiar with some of the canon, and I can see why that could be super off-putting to newer readers or to casual readers. And so again, that's like a separate debate as well.
Yeah.
But
let me there's a couple things. So are you saying you would like more, something more like a hybrid of both Bendis and Hickman? Because to me, like, I didn't really like Bendis's run that much, even though there's a lot to like in there, but it got so talking heads, you know, the talking heads up. Like, it's like, fine, that's, you know, everyone's sitting around. It's all the interpersonal play between the people. People love that. To me, it's like, I just, it felt so tedious. And
I agree and that in that complained case. About, it,
go ahead.
No, a hybrid is an intriguing notion, because in the case of Bendis, it went on for too long.
Mm-hmm.
The balance between those two types of stories, I think, is really important. And so for me, what was less exciting about Hickman at the very beginning was that he was what you are so excited about. He dove right into this from the very first issue. And it was alienating because it was so different. Mm-hmm. Now, I got over myself, like a lot of readers, and trusted, like you wanted us to, that this was, it has to be, you have to be in it for the long haul. It's not going to be resolved in a single arc. It's not going to be resolved in several months. It's going to be a much longer, even double shipping, it's going to be a much longer story. And that is kind of awesome. I mean, we're talking about the fact that I read Mind the Gap in a big chunk of a story that had been unfolding for months. And that was not alienating, but that was also because the way that I read it. Mm-hmm. I have been reading Avengers and New Avengers month to month, or issue to issue, since it's often more than once a month.
Right.
And it took me, gosh, do you remember? Like maybe 6 or 7 or maybe even more issues into it before I stopped whining about it.
Yeah. But I think that seems to be a common reaction for a lot of people with Hickman books. And I just it's hard for me to relate. Like, I don't get it as much as other people do. Like, to me, it's like I trust, and I guess it's because I had already bought into the cult of Hickman with Fantastic Four.
Right.
Fantastic Four is very similar in its, I think, in its progression as this Avengers is going to be. And I think Hickman was very honest with us from the start of Avengers, saying, we need to get bigger. And that's how it started. You know, it's like, this is a bigger book. It's not about sitting around the table, you know, talking and yakking. Like, this is, there are bigger things going on, and it's all been this build up to Infinity and then past Infinity.
And that's super cool, actually, from a character and world building standpoint, because it is very different and intentionally so. It is a departure from and an escalation of the norm. So So it's probably a much needed evolution of this franchise. And so it's, I'm sure, part of my resistance, part of a lot of people's resistance is it is that difference. It's not the group that I grew up with. And damn it, I fear change. But
I think that's true for a lot of comics readers. Like, we always, you know, we'll complain about things being stagnant, and then you kill Peter Parker and everyone's throwing death threats at you.
Exactly. Well, not exactly, because that's super uncool. But I think that we, as readers, we have so much unfair ownership, or we try to put so much unfair ownership on these characters in these stories, because they have been an important part of our lives for so long.
Yeah.
And you get this kind of weird entitlement. How could you do that to Peter Parker? How could you do that? Like, when the Thanos backstory was out a couple of weeks or months, I don't know, all the time is running together for me because I'm on vacation. but when that came out, I thought that was super interesting. But a lot of people were like, what? Why do I want to hear about or read about Thanos' background? Like, this is not necessary for this character, and I don't care his motivations and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So I myself am just honest, as though, guilty of that.
But I'll be honest, too. Like, I was one of those people initially. Like, I read that first issue, and I'm like, I mean, this is well executed, but I don't think I care. And then, you know, now that little miniseries has progressed, it's like, now I do care, because mm-hmm. because the creators are good. Like, they made me care about it.
Right.
And, you know, it's so, we forget, like, we have such short-term memories as comics readers of who's creating the stories for us, and maybe what, I think because we don't trust maybe Marvel or DC for whatever reason. And I trust Marvel a lot more than I do DC mm-hmm. to execute bigger stories in better ways.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people end up complaining about that because they just don't feel like it's going to pay off in the end.
What does pay off mean in this case?
I don't know. That's a good question. I think that's funny, because I don't know what is the payoff. Like, you feel like it's a complete well done story.
But in the case of Infinity, what are we aiming for at the very end? I felt this way with Thor recently,
mm-hmm.
and I haven't actually read this week's issue of Thor. So I have to be careful in both acknowledging my feelings and then noting that they could go completely out the window with the issue that came out 3 days ago.
Yeah.
But when it's a... when it's an existing character like that, with so much history, it's such a false set of high stakes, because you know that everything is going to be okay. Because the idea of any of these franchise characters not winning at the end is like not conceivable to us.
Yeah,
and
I think that's a conceit you just have to make when you read comics.
That's fine, but I think that there are changes that can come about from these big events. There are certainly lasting changes that have come out as a result of big moments. I mean, that is the only way that some of these characters develop. So I think that looking ahead at the end of Infinity, and I'm not asking you to predict, but mm-hmm. I think the resolution, as it were, the end of this event could put us in a different place with some of these characters than we are right now. And in this, like, Avengers world where everything is bigger, we could end up at the end of this event in a different place.
I mean, I think so. I think this is also, we've had such a kind of the whole Marvel Cosmic universe has been kind of backburnered for so long. Really, I mean, we've definitely had stuff over the years, but it hasn't been in the forefront like it is now. Mm-hmm. And that's partly because of movies and all this other stuff. But there's an architecture to the story that Marvel is doing that is better than they've done ever in the past, I think. Mm-hmm. There's forethought to it. There's planning years ahead of how things will play out. And that's what I'm excited to see. I mean, admittedly, I'm biased to this first issue because it had the Space Knights. I'm a ROM nerd, and ROM
was
in the
wondering how long into this I have to put that marker down when I do the show notes. How far into the show did it take before Aaron brought that up?
Well, come on. I mean, that was like pandering directly to me.
Yes.
And it was
sure
also
that's exactly just keep telling yourself that.
It's pretty heartbreaking too. Or like I was pretty heartbroken. I mean, it didn't make me go like, oh, this is crap or anything like that. It was amazing. And I also heard afterwards too that Hickman has plans for the Space Knights post Infinity. So that's pretty exciting too. but yeah. So I definitely am biased in that.
Where are the Guardians of the Galaxy?
I don't know yet.
What, shouldn't they be part of this little club right now?
Well, yeah, we'll see. I mean, there's a lot on the board. And they're busy doing other stuff, who knows? I mean, maybe you can only have so many characters in at once. I mean, there's already what, like 50 characters going on so far.
Sure, but the cosmic universe that you're speaking about and the the investment in the epic storytelling, I agree with you. It feels bigger. And it feels like we've been warned that it was going to be bigger from the very beginning.
Yeah.
But who knows?
Continuity-wise, it's always weird when you have ongoing books that have their, like, you have Iron Man going on, but has Iron Man's the main title, isn't really going, it doesn't interplay like this. It'll have its tie-in book. But then the rest of the book continues, and it seems like continuity-wise, everything's disjointed when you have an event going on. But you just kind of have to get used to that the stories that are going on right now are still going to go on, but the event is comprised of itself, and they'll still tie in every book into the event to sell more books.
Sure.
And that's fine as long as it's well done. You kind of almost have to take that tie-in book separate from any kind of main title you're reading and just put it into your Infinity stack.
Do you think that your excitement about this event, how much of that do you think is Hickman's doing? Do you think it is about the architecture, or do you think it is your connection to his success with other characters in the past, where success is very personal, right? Like very much enjoyed his Fantastic Four run. Mm-hmm. So do you think you're projecting that onto this and you're being more forgiving?
Well, no, because it's not like I've only read Fantastic Four. Like I like Hickman's books. Like I've read all, like at least the vast majority of his independent work too.
Right.
And I might even enjoy those more than his mainstream work. So I trust, I like him as a creator.
Mm-hmm.
And I get the feeling too of Marvel versus DC. Like Marvel has given him the ability to write the story he wants to write.
Mm-hmm.
And tie this basically into the entire Marvel universe. Like, that's really exciting to me.
Right.
Like, I don't feel like his writing is impersonal or separated out. I don't think he gets kind of, he doesn't drill down into characters in Avengers yet, like he does, like maybe Bendis did. But I don't think it's those kind of books either. Like, to me, it's like, I always feel like in a team book like this, is not so much about the interpersonal and getting to know the characters deeply. Like, you can have that maybe one every six issues. Like, you kind of spotlight somebody to make you feel more tied to them. But I think that's kind of what their solo books are more about. And the team book should be about epic battles and events and problem solving.
Which is more important to you? Like, I identify myself as connecting with character more than story development. That doesn't mean story isn't important. It's just that you give me characters that I am into and you plop them down in most any environment and I sign me up. Do you identify yourself in one way or the other?
I like them both. I mean, I like the solo books. I like learning about the characters deeply, but then I want to see them get together and solve bigger problems.
Okay.
And they're both important. That's why you have their solo books and you have their team books.
Right, but I think that's a balance right now that hasn't always been in place. That's a structure right now that works with a couple of very key characters. And that is not the way that I grew up reading comics. And I think that that is a relatively recent phenomenon where you can showcase individual characters and a range of individual characters. Like, in other words, it's not just that Cap has his own book and that Iron Man has his own book.
Mm-hmm.
We've got Hawkeye and we've got Captain Marvel, and the two types of tales are working well together now. I was just sort of curious if you think that you as a reader respond more to the kind of epic story building as opposed to the more intimate character building.
Yeah, I think so. I like a complex story that I don't know how it's going to play out. Like, I like a non-linear story that way, that there are a lot of different scenarios going on and that have a good resolution at the end. But I want to be taken up to that point where I'm still trying to figure out where everything goes together until it does.
Is that true for other media for you?
Sure, yeah. I like a complex movie that I'm watching it and I don't need to know what's going on scene to scene. But it starts to reveal itself as the movie progresses,
okay.
or a book or whatever. Like I like having to think about that and then taking breaks and like wondering what's going to happen next. And oh, there's this going on, but maybe this will go on. And what if they did this? And you know, as opposed to oh, well, I know he's going to go. He's got this to do. He has to go find this guy. They're gonna fight. There's gonna be a resolution, and then move on. You know, like. Those are fun, but they don't work your brain the same.
Sure. And I think there's a danger in the way that I'm describing it. I'm oversimplifying it and I'm not, I don't want to make it sound like I'm so into character that I am not interested in sophisticated storytelling. Quite the opposite. But if there is a really intriguing outlet for the way that story is being told through character discovery, then it resonates with me a lot more. And I'm also fiercely protective of those characters. And I have been since I was little. That's the part that sticks with me. Sometimes I'm woefully bad about remembering important plot points in books or movies that I read ages ago. But if there was a particular person who I connected with, then that will stick with me for years.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that it is, part of that is just, you know, me, my personality, and the way that I read or the way that I observe. And so it's interesting to hear your take on something as vast as Infinity and other kind of Marvel events or that universe as a whole and what resonates with you.
Yeah, I agree, but I think we're into the realm of speculation now and probably should see.
Yep.
We'll see how we'll revisit this. I think this is going to be a good one for us to debate as it starts to unplay, you know, or play itself out.
See you at the end.
Yeah. if we survive.
Hey, this is Nicole, or Miss Fury, or Madam Fury, as I'm sometimes referred to in Twitter circles, and my nerd confession is that sometimes I dance to the love theme song of Princess Leia and Han Solo. I'm not going to hum it, but if you think back to the movies, there's this little romantic theme song. I think it's playing as he goes down, you know, and he's about to be carbonated, whatever. So yeah, I do some pretty hardcore ballet and humming to that song, and that's pretty nerdy. So I don't know. I don't know if I need help or just guess it feels good to get it off my chest. Thanks. Bye.
So lastly, we've got the True Lives of the Fabulous Killjoys, number 3, written by Gerard Way and Sean Simon and drawn by Becky Cloonan. This is by Dark Horse Publishing. Andrea, tell me about it.
So this is written by My Chemical Romance frontman, Way. He also wrote The Umbrella Academy. Mm-hmm. And it is set in a kind of post-apocalyptic California, roughly around the Los Angeles area. And it centers around the girl who was featured in the two My Chemical Romance videos, Na 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 and Sing. They're mm-hmm. both available on YouTube. I highly recommend that you watch them in tandem with the book mm-hmm. just to get a sense of the atmosphere and a little bit more fanciful glimpse into this world. In the comics, though, we're looking at this girl about 12 years after the events in the video. After the deaths of the Killjoys, which is this band of teenage kind of vigilantes who are living outside of the city, Battery City, which is controlled by Better Living Industries. And the Killjoys were her protectors. Now they are gone and she's been in hiding. But we don't exactly know how she's been doing that or what she is hiding from. There are some new wannabe Killjoys in the desert area, again, outside of this very strange corporate-controlled city. And we meet Cherry Cola, the only, seemingly only surviving member of the group who had protected the girl years ago. And he doesn't trust the new kids, doesn't want her to get mixed up with them. But we don't know a lot about his motivations or what he's been doing in the interim either. He's a DJ, and is the role of the DJ in the story is kind of one of mentor and guide. Their influence pops up, their voice pops up at certain points, kind of narrating for us as well as for the characters. And then there's also porno droids, because, like, why wouldn't there be?
Of course, especially right. in a city that you live better in.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, well, okay, so overall, first three issues, did you like this or not?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. This is totally my kind of story.
Okay.
It is complex, and it is intriguing, and it is literally the only way that I can get into post-apocalyptic storytelling. normally, that's not my bag, but this one is super fun, and yes, absolutely, bring it on.
And it's funny, because it's like, to me, I'm also very biased on any kind of like dystopian literature, like that I'm drawn to that very heavily for some reason. So it's like almost, it's hard for me to be objective when I'm reading books like that. It already is going to get a big kind of attention from me anyway.
Wow. I feel such the opposite. Like after, I can trace it exactly to after Avi was born.
Hmm.
I just like can't handle that kind of stuff at all anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I think anything, well, that's a different discussion about having kids and then watching things that are kind of, especially involving kids, that are emotionally very charged, but mm-hmm. we'll save that for the next segment. but to go back to this, I think a lot of people have been complaining because it's well, the concept of the book is interesting because it's a it's almost like a conceptual comic based around a concept album.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with that.
No, I don't have a problem with that either. I think maybe the fault of the book itself is that it doesn't say, like, on the first page, hey, go watch these two videos. Go watch them, like, six times before you even read this first issue. I hadn't read that. Or I hadn't seen those videos until after I read the first issue. And I liked the first issue fine. I was very, like, okay, I kind of get what's going on here. There's a lot, but there's a lot unsaid. And then I saw somebody talking about the videos, and I went and watched them. And I'm like, oh, this makes a lot more sense now. And I think it's hard to get to tell people maybe to do that, or to have to give it. It's like going back to homework for a book.
Mm-hmm.
But you'll definitely enjoy it a lot more if you really kind of understand what's going on in the first two videos that are like the prequel to this story.
And I think it's a really interesting blend of medium. I think in this particular case, we've got a writer who is very invested in both methods of storytelling, like music mm-hmm. and comics, and has proven success in both worlds. And this seems a very natural blending of the two. I agree with you that the way that it's presented in the comic is not really acknowledging the first method of storytelling. And I wonder... because the band broke up in March, and this is 100% speculation, but I wonder if any of that has to do with, because the comic first issue came out in June, right? So I wonder if there's anything, I know he announced it a couple of years ago, but I wonder if there's anything to be said about the lack of screaming from the hilltops about the connection because of the kind of state of relationships within, like, the band. Who knows? I just think it's weird that there isn't a more direct presentation of the connection.
Yeah.
But it's not a secret. I'm not saying that it's a... Right. You don't have to dig very far to come up with it, but it's a kind of a loss if you haven't.
Right, yeah. It's not necessary, but I think it definitely sets the stage for this book, if you know, are familiar with that album and you've watched those videos.
Mm-hmm. This story reminded me of a couple of different other things that I have read. Are you familiar with Harrison Bergeron?
No.
It's a short story by Kurt Vonnegut, and you should read it. You could read it this afternoon and report back to us on the Twitters. But it has that corporate control over individual thinking that is a very kind of common meme in dystopian fiction, where you have to put the headphones on so that you're not hearing other things, or you're not thinking about other things, or in fact you are only listening to this state prescribed or corporate prescribed whatever it is that you have to listen to.
Sure. I mean, but that's not like Fahrenheit 451
absolutely.
Or 1984. I mean, it's not, you know, it's probably not, I guess it's not a unique kind of dystopian execution.
But it is something that I think we relate to in how unrelatable it is. We recognize it as a conceit because it's used in, it tells us a lot about the society without having to tell us a whole lot more about the society.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair. These are all kind of warnings to me of, you know, a lot of dystopian literature, one way or the other, are warnings about society and how we, how limiting freedoms will lead to, you know, kind of loss of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, that's kind of what they're all about. I don't think this is any exception. It's just in how the story is, where you fill in the pieces to that.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're three issues in. I think it's a six issue story. I think the art is great. Clunan's art is great.
She's delightful.
Yeah, I don't blame people for maybe not being super stoked about it yet, but I think it's the same people that might not enjoy like Umbrella Academy too. Like they're written differently, and it's also it's also easy to dismiss a rock star guy as a comics writer. I think Gerard Way is like one exception to the rule that I've ever read of being someone who was a celebrity in another medium being able to write a good story, you know, a good comic.
Sure. I think in his case, it was, he was not coming into it as a novice.
Yes.
He had that interest and that desire long before. And like I said, he had the ability to tell stories in both music and in comics. And my understanding is that it was comics, and then it was music, and then it was back to comics, and then back to music. And so I think it's been a very natural path for him, as opposed to some other more recent failures. Mm-hmm. In terms of celebrities joining the kind of comics as storytelling world and being less comfortable with the medium.
Yeah.
Because let's be honest, it's a very different way to express yourself if you are more exclusively comfortable expressing yourself in music.
Yeah. For sure.
But I think that he very uniquely has the experience in both and some training in both. And I do think he's an exception. And I happen to be a pretty big fan of Umbrella Academy mm-hmm. and the style of storytelling. And so I'm not sure that is directly responsible for why I thought... Why I think that Killjoys is a lot of fun. But I do find it more approachable and more appealing than a lot of other like post-apocalyptic worlds. It is I can't actually believe I'm gonna say this, because there's nothing appealing about like a large corporate no-name thought control kind of establishment. Mm-hmm. But yet I think because our gateway into that is less oppressed. We've got a couple of very appealing android characters that we have a lot mm-hmm. of sympathy for, mm-hmm. but we don't see humans in the city the same mm-hmm. way that we see the humans outside of the city. And so I think that is also... like we're rooting for the rebels. We're rooting for the kids outside, and
yeah.
they're gonna storm the castle, and the bad guys are gonna fall.
Yeah.
So it's different than a lot of other worlds where everybody is oppressed. Does
mm-hmm.
that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No. Yes. And it's also there's a level of nervousness to it too, because having watched the videos, the prologue is very much a downer. There is not success, so you have to wonder, will there be success in the book too?
Right.
So we'll see.
Hey there, true believers. It's Roderick Roof, aka the man that can't be stopped. You can find me on Twitter at Roderick Roof. And this is a nerd confession to my favorite comic therapist, Andrea, the Hawkeye and theater enthusiast, and my old pal, Aaron Myers, comic book social darling. My confession is in relation to The Walking Dead number 113. So in spite of Negan brutally beating one of my most beloved characters in issue 100, I find myself completely enjoying this character's banter and personality, ignoring his sociopathic psychosis. I mean, it's cool to name a barbed wire bat Lucille, but is it also cool to rub your penis on it? Help me, comic therapist. Am I Stockholm syndromed, or is Negan quite possibly one of the most entertaining villains ever imagined outside of the Big Two? Love you guys. Want to hear your feedback. See ya.
I think we're stalling. I think we're just putting off the inevitable.
Yeah, I know.
Are you ready for this?
No, not at all.
Well, you know what? It's time for grief counseling.
I don't want to do this. I'm scared and we haven't even started the conversation.
Got it. It's like a Band-Aid.
Okay. Okay. Let's do it. Let's do it.
Okay. Okay. Every week, Andrea is going to read one volume of The Walking Dead. This is the comic that got me back into comics. And now this is the comic that up until now she had refused to even consider.
Because zombies are the fucking worst, Aaron.
They're the best.
No, they're the worst. And you know, you're also kind of the fucking worst because you're going to make me talk about it. So let's get this over with.
All right, let's
talk
about
the first six issues of The Walking Dead. It's so funny to me that you keep telling me that this book is not about zombies. That the book keeps telling me that the book is not about zombies. Because obviously in the trade, there's a little essay about how not about zombies this is. It's about society, and it's about the roles that we play, and when we lose the footing that we need to keep those roles in place, like what happens. It's about people kind of finding their way. It's about fucking zombies. Right now, that is what it is for me, and that's what it's going to be for a long time. It is petrifying. It is my worst nightmare, and I think it's my worst nightmare because the society thing is obvious. It is impossible for me to separate the story from my imagining my life in that world. And that is 100% due to being a parent. If this world were to happen tomorrow, I would be dead today. There is absolutely no way that I have the skills to survive. There is no way that I could protect my child. And that is just, I am incapable of articulating how overwhelmingly frightening that is.
No, I completely understand. And I mean, unfortunately, this is going to turn into like parent cast this week, but I mean, before having kids, I was as liberal, like, you know, hippie guy as they come. And then after having kids, I started to kind of like go into survivalist mode of like, well, what do we do if, you know, the power goes out, or we have a flood, or, you know, something happens, the economy collapses. And then I started like, I bought food containers to where it's like, okay, well, we wouldn't have to go outside for 2 weeks with the amount of food containers we've got in the house now. And I've bought guns in the last couple of years that we keep. No, I've got two guns. And
wow.
4 years ago, if you said like, you know, what about people with guns? I'd be like, you know, people with guns are idiots. You know, who needs guns? That's the stupidest thing. And totally, my mentality has totally changed over the years about that. I mean, guns are still really scary, but it's almost like I felt it was almost irresponsible not to know how to use one and to have one to protect us if we had to. And it probably comes down to, too, if like in the situation where I actually had to use one, I'm sure I'd probably end up blowing up off my own foot. But it kind of helped alleviate some of that that anxiety of after having kids of fortifying the castle against, you know, the impending collapse of society and the zombie hordes that are going to come, you know, crashing through the windows.
I wonder how much that says about you and me as individuals, that my assumption is that I would just not be around. Like, I don't have to protect myself from the zombie hordes because they would have already gotten me.
Oh.
Like, the survivalist mentality is almost a different approach. It is a very different approach as opposed to my assumption of kind of guaranteed victimhood. And maybe that is it, rather than this book being a rallying cry for get your shit together, Andrea, and like protect your family. It's more like, oh my gosh, this is the worst. This is the absolute fucking worst. This is the fear of not being able to protect what is most dear to me in combination with something that is not real and therefore falls into that bucket of heebie-jeebie, afraid of the dark stuff that I have going on too. So it's like right. the worst of both worlds.
Well, yeah, and, but I mean, okay, so zombies aren't real, but zombies are a metaphor for all the,
yeah,
the danger in life.
I know that, but in this particular book, the metaphor is very tangible.
Yeah.
And that's the point. Like, the metaphor is fabulous, and it's a great storytelling device. And yes, we can all learn from that statement about our current society and its ability to survive or bounce back from something as catastrophic as an actual zombie invasion. But, like, in the meantime, there are zombies in this book, and they are scary. And I'm not going to be able to let go of that for a couple more volumes, at least. You've got to give me that. Because it is such a...
Oh, for sure. I mean, especially the first volume is about waking
yes.
up to a zombie apocalypse.
It's such an overwhelming world shift for Rick, who is experiencing it without the development of the outbreak, the same way that we as readers are. We jump
yeah.
right into it. It's absolutely beyond our comprehension. And we only stop to catch our breath when he has a chance to stop and catch his breath. And I find that very, very overwhelming and very difficult to kind of process as a reader. Like, I'm not ready for it to be a metaphor yet.
Yeah.
It is still kind of, I'm still unpacking the events. I'm still processing, like, holy shit, how did he get out of the hospital? Oh my God. No, it's raining. They're going to smell you. Oh, this is super bad. I think eventually I will get to the place where I can talk about what this story is saying in terms of interpersonal connections and what we do in times of crisis and how we as people band together to protect one another and those kind of larger issues. But I'm not ready for that yet.
Mm-hmm. No, that's fair. I mean, it's hard for me to go back to that first volume. I also read it as a big chunk. Like, I think it was about 60 issues in when I started reading it.
Okay.
And I basically read those, 60 issues in 4 days, I think.
Oh my God.
And that was like the first comic I had read again, like, since quitting comics in the 90s, for the most part. I mean, I think I read like The Watchmen or Dark Knight Returns, here and there when it was like became popular. But this is basically the first one where I picked up a book and went like, whoa, these comics are not like how they were when I was a kid. And then that kind of started everything. But it's hard to think back, whatever, 4 or 5 years ago to that point, about 4 years ago. So, yes, it will unfold very differently for you. And,
mm-hmm.
To go back to the survival or die kind of thing too, do you – and it's hard to make this not sound like I'm from like the 1950s, but – do you think it's also something like ingrained somewhat in a male versus female? Like, I don't know. Like, I feel personally when I became a father, it was my job to protect the family no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's where those kind of like thoughts went into of like, well, what do we do in this situation? Or how do we prepare for this situation? Or how do I protect us from this situation?
And
I don't know if it's a male or female, but yeah.
I obviously identify with the desire to protect my child at all costs. I think, I don't know. I don't know how much of it is a gender roles question, and I don't know how much of it is a individual difference in personality question. I don't know, for example, if my partner would have the same... I can tell you we don't have any guns in our house.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a really hard time imagining a world in which that would ever change.
Mm-hmm.
But lots of things have changed that I had a difficult time imagining before they came to pass. So anything is possible, right?
Right.
I think that more than it being male versus female, I think it has something to do with I didn't grow up with those roles being presented as strongly. We didn't have guns in the house when I was a kid. I've never fired a gun. I've never even touched a real gun. I'm thinking as I'm saying that, but I believe that is true.
Mm-hmm.
My dad used to go hunting with some family, but mm-hmm. nowhere near us. Like, he would go visit his brothers, and they would go hunting every couple of years. And mm-hmm. but he kind of walked away from that life. And so, therefore, that was not the life that my brother and I grew up with. So the entire concept of being self-reliant is one that I could not pick up very quickly at all. And I think that maybe, rather than it being like a question of gender roles, I think it has more to do with like a awareness of my own limitations. Like, I'm decidedly not self-sufficient, and would have to learn so much and accomplish so much to be even remotely close to being able to do that. And I am a product of like a very urban lifestyle, mm-hmm. and every decision that I make contributes to that. So I don't even like camping. Are you kidding me? There's nothing about the breakdown of those kind of cushy lifestyle choices that I have made that is appealing to me.
Yeah. No, I fully understand that. And I feel the same way in a lot of ways, but I grew up very rural. My parents, like, my dad's not a hunter. We did have a gun in the house. We had a 22 rifle, and the only reason we had it was because of where we lived. We'd have problems with like a skunk, or there was an occasion where like a deer got its head trapped in our garden fence, you know, to where its neck had snapped, but it hadn't died. You know, it was there because of necessity, but not for hunting, not for home defense or anything right. like that. It's like, I had very little experience with guns or connection to them. My parents are very liberal people, like hippie people. Like, they're not, you know, none of that is ever part of my upbringing. But I still did grow up in the woods, basically away from society. So that kind of lifestyle isn't foreign to me, you know, and survivalism isn't necessarily something I'm even drawn to or have any kind of affinity for or anything like that, but it's not outside of my understanding zone.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't hard for me to embrace some of that after having kids, or at least for those kind of my fears to take hold in some of that that prior learning, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what a lot of this book kind of evokes in me.
Yeah, I don't even know where I would start. I think that's I don't get past that. I don't get past the anxiety of like, oh my God, what would we do?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's no obvious answer to me
mm-hmm.
besides something super fatalistic. And so I don't progress beyond that. My only reaction is fear. And I cannot move past the fear into a very kind of organized, okay, here is what we would actually do.
Mm-hmm.
And I have seen quite a few, I'm trying to think of the best example. Oh, okay. So, the Stand, the miniseries.
Sure. Uh-huh.
There are, some at the sort of near the beginning, there are some wonderful visuals of people trying to get out of the urban areas. And so it's just car upon car upon car on the highways. And then as everybody is succumbing to the plague, it's just cars for miles that are kind of dead on the road, right? And I do know that there is nothing that could be less appealing than being stuck in a car, like tomb on a road, trying to get away, like all of the millions of other people. That is, that's a different kind of scary. But I know that that would not be like my go-to plan. But what would be? And I think that that's kind of where I stop when I process this. That's why I can't get to the metaphor, because I am still stuck in the, in my, like, I'm paralyzed by how absolutely right, paralyzed by how I couldn't do anything in the practical, like reality of that world. So maybe I'll learn something. Maybe this will actually be like, not just Andrea conquering her comics fears, but also like getting in touch with her survivalist self. I don't know. But right now I find it, the whole thing, to be like really just sort of traumatically difficult to get through.
Yeah.
Thanks.
I fully understand. I think I'm very excited to talk about this with you as the weeks go on, because the story unfolds in very different ways from this first volume. So,
well, I expect so, if it really is shifting away from being a story about zombies and more about a story of people and society, or the dregs of society after society has fallen. Like it doesn't, it's going to have to move quite in a different direction from, like, I understand the need to start with a bang, but it is, I'm not expecting it to get any easier. I did sort of agree to this knowing that it was going to be a long journey.
It is. And I'm excited for us all to go on it with you.
Thanks.
Well, I think this has been a pretty epic podcast. Hopefully people are still listening. So if you are, thanks for listening. This has been Comics Therapy. You know where to find us. It's all at the beginning of the show. Everything has been pretty meticulously put up on the website at comicstherapy.com. As always, join us every week and give us some feedback on what you thought of the show. We're always open to ideas for books we should be talking about, or things we brought up on the show that you had ideas about too. So, yeah, join us next week, and we'll talk to you this week, and, you know, try to survive.
I'll try. Red cars and sweaty bodies everywhere. Hands in the air like we don't care. 'Cause we came to have so much fun now. That somebody here might get some now. If you're not ready to go home, can I get a hell no? 'Cause we gonna go all